Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to How Undergraduate Institutions Can Diversify the Graduate Student Body. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, you may press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host today, Scott Jasik. Please begin.
Hello, I'm Scott Jasik, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on how institutions can diversify their graduate enrollments. Before introducing our guest, I wanted to share some of the context for today's discussion. Graduate education in the United States is overwhelmingly white, and that's the case at a time that the country and undergraduate education are increasingly diverse. Much of the diversity in graduate education, in fact, comes from international students, and without diminishing the contributions of those students, it's important to note that 72% of the enrollment of U.S. citizens in graduate school comes from white students, according to new data from the Council of Graduate Schools. In recent years, the rates of increase of minority students in graduate school have started to outpace that of white students, but those enrollment totals are likely to continue to be less diverse than many graduate deans and professors would like to see. Starting from that base, efforts to diversify graduate education also have challenges. For instance, many graduate programs have strict requirements based on courses one must have taken as an undergrad. So it's not just a matter of getting the attention of a college senior, but of having reached students early enough so that they can have a shot if they do decide to go to graduate school. Additional challenges are raised by the financial pressures on everyone in higher education and on students. And in some states, limits on affirmative action may make it difficult to target efforts on any one group or groups of students. Our guest today is someone with extensive experience in dealing with these issues and achieving real progress. Rick Cherwitz is a professor in the Department of Communication Studies and in the Department of Rhetoric and Writing, and a fellow at the Institute for Innovation, Creativity, and Capital at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the founder and director of the Intellectual Entrepreneurship Consortium at UT, which we're going to be talking about. I'm going to start off by posing a series of broad questions to Rick to discuss these issues, and then we're going to go to open it up to our audience. We'll invite your questions at that time. Rick, welcome. Maybe you could talk about how you got involved in these issues.
Okay, thank you. I'm happy to be here today to talk about these issues. And let me say, first of all, I would not describe myself as a diversity expert. I've been a faculty member at the University of Texas since 1978, and my sort of way of coming at these issues, it's kind of a circuitous route. As I said, I've been a faculty member for 32 years, and from 1995 to 2003, I served as an associate dean in the graduate school at UT, and for those of you who may not be familiar with the size of UT, UT has probably one of the largest graduate student bodies in the United States, approximately 12,000 graduate students, master's and PhD students. And one of the items in my portfolio from 1995 to 2003 was overseeing admissions at the graduate level for all of our colleges and schools, and that includes everything except for the law school. And some of you may know this historically, but shortly after 1995, it was probably 96 or 97, the Hopwood decision came down from the circuit court, and Texas was one of three states at that time that was prohibited from using race and ethnicity as a factor in admissions. In fact, we couldn't even reveal that data explicitly. We couldn't ask students for it. And so our hands were tied behind our back compared to most of our competitor schools around the country. And this caused me to start looking at the data quite a bit, because I had always assumed that schools like UT had been quite successful in terms of increasing diversity. And one of the first things I discovered was that even before Hopwood, while we had done a lot of very good things and had increased underrepresented minority enrollment, in some ways, the way I would describe it, we were, like many institutions, playing a shell game. We were simply redistributing an existing population. We weren't substantially growing the applicant pool of people who might potentially be interested in master's and doctoral degrees. What we were getting good at is taking a self-selected audience of students who were interested in graduate school and recruiting them to UT so that maybe they wouldn't be going to Stanford or MIT or Harvard or any of a number of other institutions. So the concern for me at that time, and again, I had no experience with these issues. As I said, diversity was not, and demography was certainly not one of my areas of expertise. So my first concern was, how do I, as a graduate dean, start to think in ways that would allow us to develop in all of our colleges programs that would expand the applicant pool and take individuals who historically may not have been interested in pursuing advanced study and going from there. So that's sort of one side of the way that I came from the issue, and I'm going to describe the other way, and when I do, you'll see how these two worlds collided and sort of led to a surprise for me, a sort of unintended consequence about how to increase diversity. So the first half of the story was I'm overseeing admissions for the university, worried about our applicant pool not being large for underrepresented minorities. At the same time, and some of you who are at graduate institutions or maybe even at small liberal arts colleges may be familiar with some of these other initiatives, but the University of Texas, like so many graduate schools in the mid-1990s, was concerned with the issue of how do we better prepare our graduate students, our master's and doctoral students, for the workforce, whether they take academic or non-academic jobs. And this was a problem not only of a lack of jobs, but also the fact that many of our students didn't want to be like us. That is, the phrase that was used by many organizations in the late 90s and early 2000 was, we're cloning our students. We're training them to look like us, to be research-specific and insular disciplines, and we weren't really educating them in ways or giving them ownership of their education in a way that they could make the kind of contributions they wanted in an academic or non-academic venue. So being involved in those issues, I created a program. It wasn't originally titled this, but by 2000 it was retitled, called Intellectual Entrepreneurship. And the whole thrust of this program was, how do we change the way we do graduate education? Instead of having students develop all of these specific skill sets and knowledge within particular disciplines, how can we supplement that in a way so that they can begin to see the vast array of possibilities that they might have to make contributions in academic and non-academic settings? So we created this program, developed 18 graduate school level courses in things like entrepreneurship, innovation, communication, writing, ethics that were delivered to students in over 90 different disciplines here at UT. Well, to make a long story short, and this is where the two worlds hook up, my boss at the time, the vice president, came to me after 2 or 3 years of doing this and said to me, asked me the question, do you know anything about the demographics of the students who are taking these IE courses that your faculty are teaching in the graduate school? And I said, well, I really don't, other than I know that these are not remedial students, because I was always concerned about defending against the argument that this was remedial professional development education. So I started to do a systematic study of these students and discovered that well over 20% of these students were either Hispanic or African American. And that figures, to me, was quite a shocking figure, because UT at that time, when I discovered this 20% figure, was only about 9 to 10% of its graduate students represented those groups. So we were getting twice that many underrepresented students in these IE courses compared to the general graduate population. And so I decided, in my own naive qualitative sort of way, to go out and survey these students and have focus groups to figure out why, what was attractive about the intellectual entrepreneurship philosophy and the kinds of things we were doing. And the two things that I heard students tell me loud and clear were, first of all, and this is no surprise, is that the intellectual entrepreneurship program and courses were the only place they felt they could go to demystify the process, to level the playing field. In other words, what I was hearing these students say is, we know we're smart enough to get PhDs in physics or mathematics or chemistry or communication, but we don't know the rules of the game. We don't understand what the process is, and that is very intimidating, and your courses are all about process. They start with us and talk about what our concerns are, about how the system works, what the politics of the system are, and so on. So that was one answer I got. And the second answer I got, which was very fascinating, was they said that because the IE courses in philosophy emphasized students figuring out for themselves in a non-paternalistic way what value they could add to society and how they could leverage their knowledge to make a difference, they thought that that was specifically important to them because many of them wanted to make contributions to the community and the kinds of contributions that they could not talk about in their own programs because their faculty really wanted them to be in the labs, in the archives, and preparing themselves to look like the faculty. And so these students were clearly telling us, these underrepresented students, that they want to make a difference in the world. They don't see how their degree programs help them to see that, and so we were giving them a space to do that. So
based on this initial set of courses for grad students,
right,
how did that lead to the programs you developed for undergrad?
Right. Well, the minute I discovered that and shortly after I left the graduate school, it sort of became clear to me that if this population, this underrepresented population and first-generation population needs to be able to discover what the value of education is, maybe we need to reorient the way we approach our undergraduate students when it comes to graduate education. And so in 2003, I created a program called the Intellectual Entrepreneurship Pre-Graduate School Internship. And at that time, it was targeted primarily to juniors and seniors, and since then I have now expanded it for obvious reasons to include freshmen and sophomores. And the purpose of this course was to hook these students up with a graduate student mentor in a field that they might be thinking about for graduate education and allowing them, if you will, sort of metaphorically to be anthropologists, for them to discover from the ground up what graduate education was, what the culture of a discipline is. Because as a faculty member, my observation was, you know, we teach disciplines top-down. Students are trained very well at universities to do disciplines, to produce the products of disciplines, to take all of the courses, to be certified and get a degree. But many of them don't have the metaphor I'm going to use is a space to be able to discover what a discipline really is and how that discipline can make a difference in the world. So we created this pre-graduate school internship, which started out with 15 students and is now over 100 students every semester from every program on campus. And Scott, the statistic that's most important about this is approximately 50% or more of the students who enroll in this pre-graduate school internship are either underrepresented minority students, that is African American, Native American, or Latino, or their first generation, defined as neither of their parents graduated from college. And so we've had a very unintended but clearly important impact on this population for the same reasons that we had discovered in the graduate school.
So how do you get the word out about the Intellectual Entrepreneurship Internship? Because it's not something when people are going through the catalog that they may necessarily be looking for.
No, we do it in a variety of ways, and I have to laugh almost when I answer this question because I am a scholar of communication, and I feel like I've had to relearn my own discipline in terms of the pragmatics of getting the message out. But the two major mechanisms we use are these. We have on our campus, and I think it's true at most doctoral granting institutions, a network of all of the graduate coordinators and advisors, that is the staff people and the faculty who run the 100 and some graduate programs on campus. So we start by going to them and asking them to send messages to their graduate students saying, would you like to be a graduate student mentor? Here's how the program operates. An undergraduate of yours in your lab or that your faculty member has had or that you've had as a TA or an AI might be flattered if you came to them and offered the possibility to be their mentor in this sort of real entrepreneurial, organic kind of class. So one way we get the message out is to go to the graduate student side to get them and their faculty to go out and find students who might want to participate. The other way we do it is we have obviously a network, as well as most campuses do, of all of the undergraduate advisors on campus that represent our many different programs, and we get them to send messages. A good example of that is we're sending the message now for the spring because students are getting ready to start registering for the spring. So in early October, we send a message out to all the undergraduate advisors who then send it out to their students. Plus, we have a vast network that we've now developed of websites on campus where we have web presence, various portals that we use on our web page that are targeted at undergraduate students. I've got an advisory board. So it's become quite easy after the first couple of years to get the message out.
So to just a few details first. Now, do the undergrads get credit? Do the grad mentors get paid?
Okay, let's take the undergraduate side first. The undergraduate students get credit. They can earn either 1, 2, or 3 hours of credit, and that depends on what they propose on their contract they're going to do. We use a contract method. That is, I have on the pre-grad internship webpage a PDF contract that basically is something that allows the intern and the mentor, and if there's a faculty supervisor, to sit down and negotiate the kinds of things that the student might do. For example, it might be anything from shadowing, engaging in research projects, attending national conferences, going to the graduate students' classes, all kinds of things, looking at other institutions, working on GRE applications. It can be anything from logistical kinds of things to more disciplinary cultural things. And the idea here is it has to be organic. We don't believe one size fits all. We believe that a student should be sitting down with their mentor and faculty supervisor and saying, this is what I'm interested in. Now what might be some experiences that we could begin to develop? And then as the semester goes on, the contract is modified depending on how their interests in the discipline or the disciplines develop. So they submit a contract to me and sign off on it indicating whether they want 1, 2, or 3 hours. So the undergraduate student gets academic credit. On the mentor side, they don't get any academic credit, but I have negotiated with all of our deans on campus and have been able to get a little bit of money from them so that I can provide travel support to conferences to the mentors and the interns for students in the disciplines of whatever the dean of the college is. So some of the mentors and the interns can get support to it. And this is a big advantage of this program. One of the best ways I've discovered to attract underrepresented minority students is not only immerse them in the culture of the discipline, but get them off to a conference even if they're not participating in a research project so that they can, meet their future sort of footnotes and see what the discipline is like. So the mentors can often, and the interns, be paid to support travel. The other thing that I do for the mentors, and I don't have enough money to support all of them, but because of the Vice President for Diversity and Community Engagement, whose portfolio IE resides in, I am able to offer a number of $500 stipends to some of the mentors who work with first-generation and underrepresented students. And clearly, it's not even half of them, but at least it allows me, and we're trying to raise money to be able to support that. So the mentors don't get academic credit, Scott, but they are able to get support in the form of stipends sometimes, and the mentors and the interns both are eligible for travel grants.
Now, given the interest in the sort of diverse pool that you attract to the program, is there any attempt to match up undergrads with graduate student mentors who share racial, ethnic, gender backgrounds?
Well, it's an excellent question. We do not systematically try to do that. I mean, it's hard enough tracking all of these people, but we actually have found that there are, for example, when I go to the graduate student mentors, many of whom are underrepresented and have been part of McNair programs that come from some of the campuses of your listeners, a lot of them really believe in the value of this, and so they will go out and try and find perhaps somebody like them. But one of the real interesting things in this, and I don't want to underestimate the value of this, is by not micromanaging that, we've had some wonderful situations where, say, an Anglo second, third generation graduate student winds up working with a first generation or underrepresented minority student, and that is a terrific education and professional development. It's diversity training for these future professors. And so I think one of the values of this program that I would not want to change is to make sure that we don't just have mentors of the same color, race, ethnicity, whatever, or the same background. The other way I would answer the question, Scott, is to say to you that even though each student has one faculty, supervisor, and or graduate student mentor. That's just the point person. The idea is that once this person, the mentor, takes on the role of mentor, they are as part of introducing the culture to the student, they are introducing the student to graduate students and other faculty within that discipline. And so many of them are able to, if not directly work with, at least indirectly work with people who look like them and have similar backgrounds.
Well, I want to ask you about how this idea can be applied elsewhere. So let's say we have some of our listeners today are at liberal arts colleges or strictly undergraduate institutions. So they don't have a large graduate student population as you do at UT. How can they apply this idea?
Okay. Let me kind of brainstorm two or three different ideas, and then maybe when we go into the question and answer phase of this, we can kind of flesh some of these out. But one way I think this can be done is by developing consortia. And again, some of your listeners may be familiar with this. Back in the mid-90s, there was a national movement from the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and I believe the Council of Graduate Schools, to develop what was called a Preparing Future Faculty Program. In fact, that was part of our IE initiative in the graduate school. And what that did is it put together schools in a 30, 40, 50-mile radius of one another. So, for example, for UT Austin, we were in a consortium that had a community college, had a historically black institution, had a small liberal arts college, and a couple of private schools. And the purpose of this program was to get our doctoral students to their campuses as a way of showing them the kinds of jobs and the kind of environments they would go into after graduation. Well, one possibility, and it's one I've actually already done as part of the pre-grad internship, is to work with some of these same schools and bring their students both virtually and physically to our campus. So, for example, St. Edward's University has a large Latina population. They're just down the road from us, and they have a McNair Scholars Program. And almost all of their McNair Scholars participate in a version of our pre-grad internship where they actually have a graduate student mentor from UT. They can't be on UT's campus as much as our students can, but they're able to basically do the same kinds of things. So, one sort of, and I do this with several other schools, one answer to this is for schools, small liberal arts schools or comprehensive institutions, private schools, who sit in an area where there may be other institutions that do have at least master's programs or PhDs, to form a sort of consortium to allow that to happen. A second way that this might be possible, and I've thought about this when I've consulted with some of the institutions in our area, is all of these other institutions, even though they don't have graduate students, all of them have an alumni base and faculty and often community liaisons, many of whom are going to have master's and PhDs. Now, while you can't simulate the same experience of shadowing and being immersed in the culture that you would with the pre-grad internship, sometimes the contact with people in the community or alumni or faculty, where the focus is not on here's what I'm working on, but how did I get into this, what are the issues that you're going to face, who are people that I can introduce to you, changes the way we start to think about undergraduate education beyond simply here's my class, here's a project that you can work on, in a way that we can begin to kind of get into what I would call process variables. And the last way to do it, and it's a way I'm actually trying to get some grant money for now, is to really, I would say, totally transform undergraduate education, to basically take what we've learned from the pre-grad internship and design what I'm calling an academic community mentorship program, where we would take freshmen and sophomores, second semester freshmen, first semester sophomores, and instead of having them simply fall into majors and take classes, we would create a kind of entrepreneurial incubator like the pre-grad internship, where they would work with a community liaison, maybe a faculty person or a graduate student on campus, and the whole purpose of this would be discover what your passion is, what is it you want to do, what kind of a contribution do you want to make, and then figure out on the basis of that what are the knowledge and skills you're going to need. Because I find this totally lacking in undergraduate education, and it's what's been the key to the pre-grad internship. So why not take that to all students potentially, whether or not they're interested in graduate school, so that they're starting with their passions and their interests rather than with disciplines?
Now, right now we're in a period of intense economic difficulty in higher education, and I'm sure all of our listeners are dealing with tight budgets. How expensive is it to do the kinds of initiatives you've done? Is a big budget needed? Do you need a lot of foundation support?
Well, it depends what hat I wear. I mean, I would tell you when I'm out seeking money, it requires a big budget. But the honest to God's truth on this is I have operated all the way since my days in the graduate school on discretionary money for the most part and not very much of it. In fact, when I first started doing the pre-grad internship, I had absolutely no money. I'm a full-time faculty member, and I did this just because I was excited about it and I wanted to do it. So there was no infrastructure support, and found that many of the faculty, and specifically the graduate students, were willing to do this for free. Now, is that as rich an experience as when you can put money into it to support travel and mentors where you have more accountability? No. So ideally, it would be nice to be able to come up with, you know, a few hundred dollars to support the mentors that are involved. But I think you could do this all the way from a shoestring budget to kind of a Cadillac budget. And where I am now is I want to develop a Cadillac budget for this because I really want to go more aggressively at the outcomes. But it's not necessary to start these things. And I think the best evidence of that is the impact that we have already had. It would surprise probably your listeners to know this, but there practically has been no money in this. I have an institutional budget now for my pre-grad internship, which remember is serving over 200 students a year, that is about 30-some thousand dollars, which basically allows me to hire a graduate student to help me organize this and allows me to pay some of the mentors, and then I get another $30,000 to $40,000 in discretionary money from the deans to support the travel of some of the students. That's not a lot of money given the size of the program. So I'd like a lot of money, and that's ideal, but you don't need much money to get these things started. You just need somebody who's committed to the effort and who understands the principle.
Now, you talked about changes in undergraduate education shifting to graduate education. Based on your experience, the graduate admissions process, something that could benefit some from reform to encourage the recruitment and enrollment of a more diverse student body.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was, again, I didn't tell the complete story on that, but one of the conclusions that I came to, and I wrote a piece 5 years ago maybe in the Journal of Hispanic Higher Education, is that, and I'll just lay my politics out, I am a firm believer in affirmative action programs and aggressive recruitment and admissions policies that most institutions have adopted and the Supreme Court now seems to be allowing. But the problem with doing just that is that those are what I would call institution or place-based approaches to increasing diversity. They're all based on this notion of how do we increase the number of students that we enroll in our institution. They're not fundamentally based on person. That is, they're not based on the idea of how do we go out and start working with students as early as their freshman year and maybe even dipping into the high schools and the community colleges and figuring out what their passions are and letting them discover that the answer, that their ability to do what they want to do with their lives depends upon getting an advanced degree. To me, that's what has to happen. So rather than thinking in traditional admission terms at the graduate level, which are place-based, we need to start thinking in entrepreneurial person-based ways of how do we get people excited about what they want to do, discover what they want to do, and then come to the realization that if they want to do that, it's going to require advanced knowledge. And in the case of underrepresented students, how does that allow them to go back home and tell their parents, many of whom are not going to understand what a graduate degree is? They're going to see it as very vacuous and opaque. How can we now tool them with the ability to say to their parents, I want to make a difference in the world. I want to come back and serve a community. And the way to do that is by getting a PhD in anthropology or communication or whatever. Because, again, typical recruitment and admissions programs, while wonderful, and as you started out the conversation with, have produced some good effects, they are not the answer to the problem, and I have described them as necessary but not sufficient.
At this point, I'd like to have our operator explain to our listeners how they can pose questions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a question at this time, simply press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. Again, to queue up for a question, please press star, then one.
And if you want to ask questions but not have your name or institution identified, you may email them to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read them without identifying who you are. While we're waiting on questions to start to come in, Rick, I wonder if you could talk about the results that you've seen from the undergraduate programs you've created in terms of whither people go on after participating to seek a graduate education.
Okay, and most, I will say to your listeners, most of our data thus far is based on surveying students via email after they've graduated, and I am only beginning now to put together a database and trying to locate funding so that I can systematically study these people. But the answer to your question is approximately 50% of the undergraduate, UT undergraduate students who go through the pre-grad internship and then get their baccalaureate degree, 50% of them are going on and pursuing master's and PhD degrees. And as I've noted on my webpage, many of these students are going on to very prestigious institutions, including UT Austin. So about 50% of them are pursuing advanced degrees. The figure for the underrepresented population and first-generation population, it's almost identical. It's like 51%, 52% of those students who complete the course, the internship, and then graduate are going on and receiving advanced degrees. And we have a lot of good anecdotal data that we put on our webpage, testimonials, narratives, essays these students have published that indicate that for many of these students, they would not have gone on to get a graduate degree had they not done it. The other big impact that we've had, and I can't quantify it in terms of numbers, but many of our students now who were undergraduate interns are now graduate students at UT. They have become mentors in the program, so they're now second generation, and several of them have gone off to other institutions where they're trying to replicate and do similar things. So the principle, if you will, is being spread.
Well, I'd like to take our first question from the phone line. Operator, could we have the first question there?
Yes, our first question comes from Maya Holtzman with UW-Madison.
Yeah, this is Nancy Matthews, and you partly covered my question when you talked about assessment, but might you elaborate a little bit more on what additional criteria you would use to assess the success, talk a little bit about the collateral impacts, as you mentioned, in terms of secondary impacts, and if you have plans for longer-term longitudinal studies?
That's an excellent question, and right now, other than the data that I've given you, I have not had the resources to follow up in a systematic way, and I am really interested in the sort of collateral effect, and this goes back to my days as a grad dean. I not only want to know how many of these students are going on to master's and doctoral institutions and where they're doing that, which we have a pretty good idea of now. I want to know, you know, all the things that a grad dean wants to know. I want to know, are these resilient, happy, successful students? Are they completing their degree? Because one of the things I suspect, and I can only offer you anecdotal evidence, is I've had a lot of students who have now actually finished their graduate degrees, and they're emailing me, again, it's only anecdotal, but they're telling me that a lot of the normal political, bureaucratic things that weigh heavily on other graduate students didn't weigh heavily on them because they figured this out, you know, in their sophomore or junior year when they took the pre-grad internship. So they understand that graduate school is no fun sometimes, that and they also understand that if you figure out what the value of the degree will be and you understand what the hurdles will be and you know what the obstacles are, you're not going to waste a lot of negative time. And when I was a graduate dean, I used to tell my president when I developed the IE courses for graduate students that it was worth investing money in this because there are so many students, and at Wisconsin you clearly understand this, there are so many students who simply default into graduate school for the wrong reason. They drop out. They don't finish their degrees. They don't finish in a timely fashion. And these are costly, both in terms of money and people's lives. And so the answer to your question is I want to systematically be able to I want to be able to interview these students and find out what some of the obvious and non-obvious consequences of the program were. And right now, I don't have a systematic way of doing that, and I'm trying to get money together so that I can begin to figure that out.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Our next question comes from Margaret Van Braun.
Hello, this is not Margaret, but I have a question anyway. My question is on your on your graduate students that are being working with the undergrads. Is there training provided for them as a check base? And my base of my question is this: is, you know, that's a really good idea, but sometimes students can come across as has not been as positive as they could, and I'm just wondering if there's a little check and balance there. And then my second question is on the alumni base. That's another great idea. How do you engage your alumni to be part of that? Thank you.
Okay, let me answer your second question first. Right now, we do not systematically involve our alumni in this. In the proposed academic community mentorship course that I want to develop, we're going to work through, if we get the money, our ex-students association and our disciplines to engage them, because a lot of these people I talk to are eager to be community liaisons. The only thing I will say, and this is on your second question, is that for some, it's not a requirement, but for some of our IE pre-grad interns, we will allow them and assist them in finding a community liaison. For example, many of our students who are doing their pre-grad internship in law, we've had many law students who are now practicing law in town who even were a part of this program, and so in addition to working with a law student mentor, the student now is simultaneously getting to work in the trenches to see what it's like to actually utilize a legal education to do something. So I want to be clear, we are not formally doing that as a part of the pre-grad internship, but it's something I desperately want to do if I have the resources to do it. Your other question is an excellent question, and I vacillate on this one between the sort of organic, laissez-faire kind of approach and a more rigorous checks and balance system. Right now, we do not require formal training for our graduate students, and this goes back to when I was a graduate dean and taught a lot of these classes. One of the things that graduate students or faculty are very stingy with their time. So if you come to them with a program that says not only are these the kinds of things that you're going to be able to do, but we're going to require you to go through training and a lot of hoops, you're going to miss a lot of people who could be very good. Now, having said that, you know, we try to, and I can't do it with every one of the 80 or 90-some mentors I have, but we try to get them to teach themselves. We develop websites, Blackboard sites. I will often meet with groups of the mentors to talk about what they're doing with their interns, and I have built-in checkpoints during the semester where I check in with the mentor or the faculty supervisor to say, all right, I need to know what's going on. I need kind of an update or a progress. I'm not going to ask you to write a 10-page report, but I need you to tell me sort of what's going on and what problems you're facing, and we will often intervene in that and say, if these are the problems you're having, this is what we recommend, or here are a number of other mentors that you might talk to. We also have built-in checkpoints, in fact, very systematic checkpoints with the undergrads. And this is something, Scott, that I didn't originally answer. But in addition to working with their mentor and their faculty supervisor, these students are meeting with us, all 100 and some of them, at 5 points during the semester, and they are actively participating in a Blackboard site where they have assignments, where they post reflections, where they interview faculty, where we get a very clear indication of what they're doing. And oftentimes, based on those, we will go back to individual mentors because we'll recognize that there seems to be a problem that's developing. And it's a good lesson about graduate education and being a faculty member. So it's a teachable moment both for the intern who aspires to be a graduate student, and it's a teachable moment for the floundering mentor who is going to be a faculty member someday. So the answer to your question is, we do not have formal, what I would call formal, regular training, and part of that is deliberate and for a reason, but again, it's also resource-based. I think if I had more resources for this and had personnel, I might err a little bit further along the continuum to having more what you're calling checks and balances, but we do have some now.
Okay, I want to read one of the questions that I've received by email. Is the program selective? Are you able to accommodate all the applicants? If not, how do you decide who is selected?
Good question. So far, we have been able to accommodate all, but it is selective in one sense. That is, a student has to have, I believe it is a 2.5 GPA, because the course they're enrolling in is an upper division course, which at UT requires that GPA. But the only selection criteria we use is they have to draw up this contract, and they have to sign it and agree to participate in it, and they have to have a faculty mentor, a faculty supervisor, and or a graduate student mentor sign it. So you can see why this program has grown, and we may reach the point where, unless we do get additional funding, I don't know if we can accommodate. I mean, this semester I've got approximately 140 students doing it, and I would say we're trying to make the adjustments, doing a lot of electronic things. We can't obviously spend as much time with the students individually, but we have accommodated every one of the students that meets those standards of filling out the contract, making it a legitimate contract, and then meeting the GPA requirement.
Okay. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Our next question comes from Cassandra William with Allen University.
Yes, this is Ken Austin at Allen University, and I have two questions. One is, what type of faculty did you recruit for teaching the IE courses, and what were their diversity?
Okay, I assume you're talking about the graduate school part of this when we developed the IE curriculum.
Yeah.
For me, this was, again, one of those things that, you know, because nobody's trained to do these sorts of things. I actually started this. The very first person I hired to start delivering these courses was a PhD student from my own department in communication studies who had had systematic background at a lot of different kinds of institutions and had been involved both in academic and non-academic affairs. And the second person that I hired was also a member of my own discipline. In fact, in this case, a doctoral student of mine who gave up tenure at the University of Memphis to come to UT because he wanted very specifically to be working with students across the curriculum on issues that involve community engagement, interdisciplinarity, all the kinds of things we're talking about. Now, and there have been a few other part-time people that I hired when I was a graduate dean. In terms of diversity, I don't know what the data on this is, but I would say probably maybe 20 to 30% of the people who taught this were either first generation or underrepresented minority. But one statistic I will give you that is sort of interesting on this is the vast majority of the people who taught these classes and who worked in the program with me were women. And that's not a shock to me because a lot of the kinds of skill sets that we're talking about and ways of thinking are more cooperative than what I would say Darwinian, which is the typical way I would describe graduate education. So it was sort of seat of the pants. I mean, part of the issue here is that, you know, there aren't people trained in particular disciplines. You can go into fields like sociology, communication, even some areas of business, and find people with the ability to teach courses in innovation, entrepreneurship, who understand the environments, but there isn't a particular discipline that one would look for.
Thank you. Operator, could you explain again to people how to ask questions and then give us our next question?
Absolutely. Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you have a question, you may simply press star, then one. Our next question comes from Marcela Gallegos.
Hi, this is Javier Cervantes. I am not Marcela, but she's here. Just a couple of questions that I had for you. What influence did geographically, what kind of influences do you have in terms of the students that you have going to UT to access such a diverse population? And the second question is, what kind of support do you give students who complete the internship in terms of monetary support for continuing on their grad school experience?
Okay, let me take the first question, and I assume you're talking about where these students are coming from that are at UT that are participating in the pre-grad internship. And again, this is really an institutional question. I mean, UT, and some of you may not know this, UT, I would say 90% of our undergraduate population comes from the state of Texas, and it may even be larger than that. And one of the things that I have discovered about the pre-grad internship interns who participate in this, particularly the underrepresented minority students, is that they're coming from the places you would suspect. We get a number of students from border towns, a number of students from our large urban areas like San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. And let me just stop there before I answer the second question. One of the very interesting things that I discovered, particularly with our Latino students who come from these various areas geographically, is that one of the biggest challenges for them in terms of whether or not to go to graduate school is not just figuring out whether or not they can do this and whether or not they want to do it. It's what I referred to earlier. It's a family problem. Many of these students are very much influenced by their family, and so a lot of these students would come to me during the internship and say, my challenge is how do I go back home and tell my mother that rather than taking a job or coming back to Corpus Christi or Port Aransas or wherever it is, How do I explain to her that I'm going to go on now and get another degree? And one of the real positive values of IE has been these students have now not only figured out for themselves, which is the key thing, why graduate education is going to make a difference in their life and why they want to own that and be accountable for it, but they now have the wherewithal, as some of these students have told me, to go back and say to their mother, look, it, I want to make a difference in terms of improving health care and come back and do this maybe in this area, or I'm interested in literacy, and the way that I can make that contribution that maybe their parents will understand is to be able to get a degree, and then they can explain that degree in a way that most students can't explain. So that, you know, for most parents, if you say, I want to get a PhD in anthropology, they're going to go, well, what does that mean, and what do you do with that? So I can't remember, was that both of the questions? If I answered, Scott, did I answer both of those?
Of all of the questioner.
The second question was about what kind of monetary support do these students get after they've completed the internship in terms of continuing their education?
Okay, they get nothing from my program, but what I have tried to do, and this again goes back to when I was a grad dean, I created a program in the graduate school that still exists called Select Admission that allows any graduate program on campus to admit a student at any point during their, preemptively admit them during any point in their undergraduate career, and if their department chair and their dean are willing to do it, to basically reserve in advance money for these students. Now, the money doesn't help them get their undergraduate education, but it says to them, if you agree to go to graduate school now, this is the fellowship or the scholarship or the stipend that you will receive. And the part that's good about that from the student finishing their supporting their undergraduate degree is part of the Select Admissions program allows undergraduates, if they're in this program, to reserve 12 hours of graduate credit while they're an undergraduate. So it means while they're taking undergraduate courses, they can be paying an undergraduate tuition rate for graduate courses that will then count towards their degree, which will save them money down the road. So I tried to sort of link up the two programs, saying to the faculty, here's the pre-grad internship. It gives you this and the student exposure when they're a freshman, sophomore. If you're interested in them and you want to recruit them, and particularly if you want to target them because they're a part of a particular population that you're concerned about, you can go ahead and selectively admit them, waive the GRE requirement, waive the application fee, and allow them to go through this. But the answer to your question is we give them absent, not through my program anyway. We don't have any resources to give to the student. There are other programs on campus in engineering and a number of other areas that take these same students and provide them with resources that help them finish their degree. And this is one of the reasons why I want to create the Academic Community Mentorship Program, because part of the challenge here is getting the student finished. I mean, as a grad dean, I never thought about it, but I think about it now. Many of these students aren't completing their undergraduate degree, and this is a pipeline issue, and so we need programs, and as your question presupposes, we need resources to be able to support them.
I'd like to read another question that came in via email, which is sort of the flip side of the question I asked you about undergrad institutions. This person wants to know, what would you recommend for institutions without an undergrad population? We are seeking to partner with local universities, et cetera. Would you suggest something else or more?
Well, my initial take on that is, I mean, I don't know what school it is, but I do know there are lots of institutions that give primarily graduate degrees. They really don't have undergraduate programs, and I think the consortium model is the exact way to go. And if I were an undergraduate sitting at an institution nearby, I would find very attractive the possibility. Let's say the example that comes to mind to me is we have, you know, several UT Health Science Centers that are in various places around the state that obviously do not give an undergraduate degree, and we have lots of sometimes cooperative doctoral programs with them, but I would think if their faculty were willing and their administrators were willing to participate in something like this and come to an institution that does offer an undergraduate degree and say, hey, a lot of your students may be interested in MAs or PhDs in a health-related area. What if we could help these students figure out as early as their freshman or sophomore year that this might be a desirable way to go because it's going to impact on the kind of courses they take and the kind of decisions? My guess is these schools are going to jump at this opportunity. And I base that on the fact that when I talk to students' parents, high school students' parents, they're all over this. They're saying, how can we get our kids as early as age 16, you know, connected up with undergraduate and graduate programs that are going to have an impact on my child's career? So, I don't, I there's nothing to expand on. I think the consortium model would be the exact way I would go. You know, the only other way I could think of would be, again, but you'd have to connect this with an undergraduate institution, is to involve, you know, your alumni. Maybe you've got faculty now or people who got degrees from your institution who are now on the faculty of other institutions that have undergraduate programs. So there might be a way to make a connection that way.
Another question in via email. How have you avoided or worked against the potential stigma of this as a remedial program?
That's an excellent question, and that has haunted me for over 10 years. And I'll tell you one way I did it was, and I'm a rhetorician by training, I study language, is this program, when it started in 1996, was called Professional Development. And I pretty quickly jettisoned that language because that immediately took on the notion of this is remedial education for people who don't have the ability. You're trying to catch them up. And the reality was our programs were not about that. We looked at our classes and they were not just. You know, it was an unintended consequence that we were getting a lot of underrepresented minority and first-generation students. So I immediately titled this program more accurately what it is. It's intellectual entrepreneurship. It's about how do you bring together the world of thought and reflection with the world of action. How do you get people engaged with their passions and then making authentic, thoughtful decisions about what they want to do on their life? And I think most people here at UT, I mean, and this is an empirical question, we could answer it, probably in looking at this program know darn well that this is not a, I mean, I think we fought that stigma pretty well. And one other way that I fought it is, and I'm a scholar, I write about this. There is now a whole corpus of theory and literature about intellectual entrepreneurship as a platform for undergraduate and graduate education. And I think once people see that there is substance to this, it's connected to disciplines, it's not some thing that exists off there in an administrative unit, I think that allows us to get out of the stigma.
And so do you share the name if colleges listening want to use your name to avoid the stigma? You're okay with that?
I'm absolutely fine with that because for me, Scott, I mean, this is going to sound, you know, very proselytizing, but for me, this is not about UT's program anymore. This is a national issue, and it's not just a diversity issue, and my goal has become in the last 5 years, how do we change all higher education at the undergraduate and the graduate level, and how do we increase diversity and engagement and interdisciplinarity? And so to me, it's not about what UT does. It's about what all these other schools are doing and how we work together in consortia to make this happen.
Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, our next question comes from Marcia Gunpertz with North Carolina State.
Hello. I have three questions. Two are very related. One concerns matching an undergraduate to the graduate mentor. You said earlier that the application process requires the undergraduate to get the contract signed by a faculty member or a graduate student. So does that mean that the undergraduate has to find their own mentor? And could you also speak a bit about what mentors are required to do? You described the process of an undergraduate signing up for anywhere from 1 to 3 credits, and things, activities include, for example, GRE preparation. In such a circumstance, what would the mentor be required to do? To enroll the student in these activities, to accompany the student, or just to guide the student? And the third question is, has this activity led to increase in the applicant pool at UT?
Okay, let me go in order there. First of all, the question about matching, and I may not have indicated this very clearly in one of my answers to Scott, in which case I apologize. This is kind of a multiple way in, so that, for example, some interns will be matched because they will go out and we'll give them a series of ways that they can go out and find a graduate student mentor, and we do this on our website in a very user-friendly way. So, for example, we send them to our graduate coordinators, the staff people who run graduate programs, who can introduce them to user-friendly graduate students, and then the first lesson of graduate school is nobody comes to you. You've got to learn how to do that. So part of your question is right. One way we do this is by getting the undergraduates to use their their resources and with our assistance to find a grad mentor. But that's not the only way it happens, and I can't document again because I've not surveyed, but I'd be willing to bet that at least half of our interns get matched going in the other direction. Some faculty or administrator or graduate student goes out and finds the undergraduate in their lab, in their classes, in their role as a TA or an AI or a faculty member. So it works both ways. So that's question number one. Question number two, what the mentor is required to do. And again, we are organic about this, but we're not going to let people just float with this. So I want to say any and all of the things that you just did. The graduate student not only, the metaphor I would use is the graduate student at minimum has to be the coach and the facilitator. So if they're not engaged in all of the activities, they need to be opening the door and guaranteeing, ensuring that the student goes through that door and does it. So for example, if a student comes to them and says, this is something I'm interested in, the graduate student says, well, here is the member of our faculty who does this, and you could go to his lab or her class, or here are graduate students that are doing this or engaging in this research. That's how you would do it. So at minimum, they are playing the role of facilitator, because we don't want this to be a top-down class. I mean, the whole purpose of IE is how does the student figure out and then become accountable for what they do, rather than here's your template on what you want to do. In fact, I discourage graduate students from going to the intern and saying, I have figured out in advance the 10 things I want you to do. That's hardly entrepreneurial, and that's hardly going to get us beyond where we're at. The other way I would sort of answer your question is, if you were to read all of these contracts I get, you would see that there are all kinds of different things. For example, many of the students, particularly in science areas, but not just science, in social science areas, are actually having the student participate in a research project. Maybe it's related to their thesis or their dissertation, and they're publishing articles, and they're going to conferences. You mentioned a minute ago about enrolling in GRE prep classes. A lot of these mentors now are actually bringing together many students who may be doing the internship in their discipline and spending hours with them, teaching them, giving them training and research methodology. And my whole approach to this has been with the graduate students, think creatively, think innovatively about all of the doors that you could open, and as long as you can show us that you're doing these things, there's follow through with the intern, we're fine. The last question you asked was about how this has affected the applicant pool. I can't tell you because, again, this is we're talking about to date maybe 600 and some students have participated in this program, probably less than that have graduated. So if you were to look at UT's total applicant pool, which is over 20,000 applicants, I can't document it that way, but I can document for certain disciplines. I know in my own discipline and disciplines that I follow closely and when I watch these interns that they are now applying to and getting accepted by many of the programs at our university, and I know that many of them are getting accepted, obviously, at other institutions because, like many graduate schools, a lot of our faculty want our students going elsewhere to get their advanced degrees. But I do not have across-the-top data. What I have is data about individual programs and individual students, and we do know from that more people are in the applicant pool, and I think more people ultimately are being admitted and enrolling in programs as a result of this based on their testimonial, based on what they're telling us, plus based on the knowledge they're getting. I mean, one of the things that faculty tell me is that by virtue of the student having completed this program, they have a better assurance that the student knows what they're doing and is committed to getting the job done.
And I've got a real quick question that came in by email. Rick, what proportion of your teaching load is directed toward the IE program?
0%. I mean, and this is a struggle for me because, and this may change in time, but I have absolutely no administrative buyout to do this. I am a full-time faculty member, and I am simply, and this is actually a third course on top of an already full load in advising doctoral students, but I do this. I mean, ultimately, I do want the resources, and I'm going to want, and I know I'm going to get the buyout for it, but this is a labor of love, and I do this because I think this is where, because my life has changed. Ever since I was a graduate dean, I was telling a faculty member, my dean, the other day at lunch, since 1995 when I became a grad dean and started creating these programs, it's probably, and I'm going to exaggerate this, the first time I really heard students. And I don't want to sound like I was an insensitive faculty member that didn't listen to my students, but not until I started thinking about these larger issues in how we educate, not until then did I really hear sort of what students want, and that energizes me, and that's why I've done this.
Well, thank you so much. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for Q&A today, but I really appreciate the thoughtful questions from our listeners, and Rick, your thoughtful explanation of this program and the related issues. We will send all people who signed up an evaluation form where you can react to today's audio conference and suggest topics for future conferences.
Scott, can I just say one thing real quickly?
Of course.
For any of the people who are in the who participated today, I'm a very good emailer. I mean, these issues are important to me. I am happy to follow through with you individually if you've got questions or would like to talk about some of the things that you're doing. Or I'm a collaborator. The other thing is how might UT and your institution collaborate to do some of these kinds of things. So feel free to email me. Feel free to go to my web pages and look at some of the things we're doing.
And Rick, maybe you could give your email address.
It's a complicated one, but I'll do it. It's S as in Sam, P as in Paul, A as in Alan, J as in John, 737. So it's SPAJ737 at uts.cc.utexas.edu. And if people can't find that or it comes back bounced because it's the wrong one, if you do a Google search for intellectual entrepreneurship, you will find my pages and my email address.
So thanks for sharing that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a good day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the conference. You may now disconnect. Good day.